Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant, Bruce Alpert, Brian Lynn, and Dan Friedel. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report.
College teachers are finding new ways to help students find jobs in occupations where there are few openings. Some help their students reach out to people who can help them find hard-to-get jobs. This person-to-person method is known as networking. They are also offering classes that can help students learn skills outside their chosen professions. It will help them find jobs if jobs are not available in their first choices for work. Paula Vogel teaches theater students at Brown University in Rhode Island. Vogel is a prize-winning playwright. She received a Pulitzer Prize for excellence in writing. There are many more plays written than get produced. Vogel supports her students by helping them connect to a group of people who can help them reach their dreams. That includes literary agents who represent playwrights her students respect. And that also includes people working in theater productions with Brown University connections. Vogel employed two former Brown students in her show, Indecent. It closed on August 6th after 143 performances on New York's Broadway. Vogel is also big on helping talented students believe in themselves. Steven Levinson had two shows performed in New York this year. One is the hit Broadway musical, Dear Evan Hansen. Levinson is a former student of Vogel. He remembers how she took him and other students out for coffee.
She said, "If this is something that you want to do, this writing thing, I believe that you can do it." That kept me going for several years, just that one conversation, through sort of the darker moments of being in New York and trying to figure it all out. So I give her all the credit for that.
Lorraine Branham heads the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University in New York. It prepares students to work in the news media, which has been cutting jobs in recent years. Branham said the Newhouse School is offering more classes on how students can present news through the internet. Students are also learning how to produce videos and get their stories out on social media. It is a difficult job market, but Branham noted, "Our students are finding jobs after graduation." She said some wish they could get more time to do longer stories and explain important issues. But Branham said she sees reason for hope. Two major newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, are both gaining readership, partly because of stories about the Trump administration, Branham said. I like to joke about the president making journalism great again, she added.
For years, there have been jokes about English majors graduating from college with great knowledge of Shakespeare's plays, but no job offers. Michael Kuczynski heads the English department at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana. He said the school's English majors are finding work, although not always directly connected to their studies. He said businesses are employing English majors because of their ability to communicate clearly. So are public relations companies and nonprofit groups. Kuczynski said English majors also continue to teach at both the college and high school levels. For many students, it was a high school English teacher who helped them write creatively and begin to understand great literature.
Teaching for me is brand new every day, and it's so exciting to, you know, watch kids becoming passionate and committed to, you know, the kinds of things that that, you know, you find important.
Acting is another difficult occupation. It is not uncommon for 300 people or more to try out for New York theater productions, with fewer than 20 being chosen. Some actors work in Los Angeles for most of their adult lives without ever getting more than a small part in a major movie or television show. J. Ed Ariza works at the University of California, Los Angeles, or UCLA. He is head of graduate acting at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. Felicia Ruff is a professor and chair of the Department of Theater and Speech at Wagner College in New York. Both she and Ariza said there is some luck needed to succeed as an actor, but more often they agree it is all about hard work and good training. Dreaming big is important, Ruff said, but hard work, resilience, stick-to-itiveness are all extremely important. Ariza agrees. He said many UCLA acting graduates have gone on to successful careers in movies, theater, and television.
But others have found success doing something they probably did not expect when they started at UCLA. For example, some are earning a good living reading books for audio recordings, Ariza said. Others are teaching new theater students. UCLA's acting program tries to prepare students for a number of occupations so they can get jobs even if they do not get parts in popular movies, Ariza said. He and Ruff said that people put too much importance on making a lot of money or becoming famous. Ariza said he tells students seeking to attend UCLA's acting program that nothing is guaranteed in art and that succeeding is difficult. Ruff tells them that they will face rejection, even at school, as they try to get parts in college shows. She said, but that is only telling someone that one door isn't opening for them. That doesn't mean there aren't other doors for them to walk through. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Bruce Alpert.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore the origins and usage of expressions we use in everyday American English. Okay, nobody likes to be wrong. But when it turns out that we are, in fact, wrong, the best thing to do is admit it.
For some reason, in American English, when we need to admit that we are wrong, we usually eat something. For example, admitting a mistake often requires that we swallow our pride. The expression means that we must forget ourselves in order to repair the damage our mistake has done.
That's right. Or let's say you are bragging about something you can do, but it turns out you can't. If you claim that something is true when it isn't, you may have to eat your own words. Now, normally, eating is a good thing, and eating pie is even better. Blackberry, apple, and pumpkin pie are all quite delicious. However, one pie that tastes awful is humble pie. When you eat humble pie, you have to admit you are wrong. You, in a way, have to eat humility, which, according to this expression, does not taste very good.
Sometimes when we offer a challenge, we make a bet. We may use the phrase, "If I'm wrong, I'll eat my hat." This is a way of saying, "There's no way I'm wrong." In many old American films and television shows, this phrase is used as a joke. And the joke is always the same. Someone, proven wrong, shakes salt on his hat as he pretends to eat it.
Okay, so swallowing pride, eating words and humble pie, or even eating one's hat, are all fairly easy to understand. Kind of. But what about eating crow? Why is eating crow a way of admitting you're wrong?
Well, some language experts say this expression comes from English writer Rudyard Kipling. Kipling uses an image of eating crow in his 1885 short story, The Strange Ride of Morrowbie Jukes.
Morrowbie Jukes was a European colonist in India. While traveling one day, he falls into a sand pit and cannot escape. Another man, a native Indian, is also trapped in the same sand pit. The Indian man stays alive by catching wild crows and eating them. Morrowbie is full of pride as he yells, "I shall never eat crow."
However, days pass and he has eaten nothing. Hungry and facing certain death, he finally does what he swore loudly he wouldn't do, eat crow. Often, people have to eat crow when they make very bold, repeated public statements that turn out to be false. Not just individuals, the media sometimes has to do it too.
That's right. In 1948, then-President Harry Truman was campaigning against Thomas Dewey. The Washington Post newspaper predicted over and over that Dewey would win. The newspaper was wrong. After the election, they sent this telegram to the winner, President Truman.
"You are hereby invited to a crow banquet, to which this newspaper proposes to invite newspaper editorial writers, political reporters, and editors, including our own, along with pollsters, radio commentators, and columnists. Main course will consist of breast of tough old crow en glace. You will eat turkey."
And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. How do you admit you are wrong in your language?
Do you eat crow or just your hat? I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
There's a crow flying, dark and ragged, tree to tree. He's black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on something shiny.
Scientists found a prehistoric ancestor of an arrow worm among a group of fossils at two national parks in Canada. The fossils were found in what is now British Columbia, but was once an ocean. The sea worm was 10 centimeters long and had 50 spines on its head. The spines could close suddenly to capture smaller sea creatures like shrimp. The scientists reported their discovery in the journal Current Biology in early August. They are calling the creature Capinitator praetermissus. They say it lived 500 million years ago and is very different from anything alive now. Capinitator means grasping swimmer. Derek Briggs is a scientist from Yale University. He led the expedition. He said the creature was larger than today's similar worms. The arrow worms of today have teeth instead of spines. Briggs said the worm was probably a good predator because it had so many spines. The scientist said it is difficult to find evidence of these prehistoric worms because their bodies decayed so quickly. But this discovery was in such good shape, they were able to make a good guess about how the worm looked. Researchers were able to make a detailed drawing and an animation of how they think the worm moved in the ocean. Doug Irwin works for the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. He was not involved in the research. He said the discovery will help scientists better understand the worms and other life from this ancient period. I'm Dan Friedel.
Our national parks journey this week takes us to the western state of Colorado. There, you will find a 77-kilometer-long canyon. Its exposed rocks are among the oldest you will find on Earth. The canyon is so narrow and so deep that sunlight shines only briefly at the bottom at midday. That frequent darkness is what has given this canyon its name. Welcome to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park.
Black Canyon seems impossibly steep and narrow. The fast-moving Gunnison River formed the canyon over millions of years. As the river flows through the canyon, it drops an average of 18 meters per kilometer. the Gunnison River loses more elevation in its 77-kilometer canyon stretch than the Mississippi River does in 2,400 kilometers from Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico. This loss in elevation causes the river to gain speed and force. Over time, that force has carved and cut the hard rock and created the wild and jagged rock formations found at Black Canyon. That process is known as erosion.
Black Canyon attracted little attention from early Western explorers. In fact, no early Spanish explorers to the southwestern United States reported seeing Black Canyon. The first written record about the canyon came in 1873. The Ute Indians certainly knew of Black Canyon, but only its rim, never the gorge, shows evidence of past human occupation. Even today, the depth and steepness of Black Canyon make it extremely difficult for humans to access.
Birds, however, have no problem surviving in the canyon environment. Black Canyon is home to many kinds of birds. They live at the canyon rim, along its walls, and by the river. Mountain bluebirds and great horned owls live in the rim area. The owls eat seeds and berries from the pinyon, juniper, and oak trees found there. Canyon wrens sing loudly within Black Canyon. Visitors are more likely to hear the birds than see them. They build their nests on flat surfaces of the canyon walls. So do peregrine falcons. They prey on other birds. They dive at speeds up to 300 kilometers per hour to catch them. American dippers build their nests in the gorge next to the Gunnison River. A gorge is a narrow valley between hills or mountains. These dippers feed on insects and small fish.
Some people come to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park for world-class bird watching. But it is the canyon itself that appeals to most visitors. Walking along the rim, seeing the canyon's towering cliffs, and hearing the powerful flow of the Gunnison River far below is an overwhelming experience. At Black Canyon, visitors can view some of the planet's oldest exposed rocks. They are Precambrian rocks. Precambrian accounts for the Earth's history from its very beginning up until about 540 million years ago. Precambrian rocks are described as basement rocks because they are usually buried deep under the surface. They only become exposed when younger rocks have been cut away by erosion or other forces. At Black Canyon, the Gunnison has eroded the canyon walls so greatly that Precambrian rocks have become visible. Often, the canyon's rock walls look like works of art. Different kinds of rocks fold together and form colorful patterns. The patterns change as sunlight hits different parts of the walls. One area of the canyon is known as Painted Wall. It is the highest cliff in Colorado. Long pink bands of rock cover this section of the canyon, as if a person took a paintbrush to the wall. This pattern formed as hot liquid from below the Earth's surface forced its way into rock cracks. As it slowly cooled, large crystals formed. The bands get their pink color from a crystallized mineral called potassium feldspar.
Local people knew just how special Black Canyon was. They began urging Congress to protect the canyon in the 1930s. It became a national monument in 1933. And in 1999, it became a national park. The park protects more than 22 kilometers of the canyon. Most visitors spend their time exploring the canyon rim by foot or by car. Several kilometers of trails lead to many overlook points. A road also leads to several breathtaking views. The U.S. Congress named the lands below the canyon rim a wilderness preservation system. This is meant to protect forever the land's natural conditions.
Some adventurous travelers choose to explore this wilderness by hiking down to the inner canyon. There are no marked trails to guide them. Hikers must first get a wilderness use permit. These permits are free, but only a limited number are available each day. Many of the paths are difficult to follow. Some are also dangerous. The Warner Point Trail, for example, drops more than 820 meters. Walking down takes more than 2 hours. Walking back up can take up to 4 hours. The Park Service warns that poison ivy grows wildly in the inner canyon. There is also the risk of falling rocks. But to reach a place where no humans ever tried to live is the reward. In the words of a 1901 explorer to Black Canyon's river area, "Our surroundings were of the wildest possible description. The roar of the water was constantly in our ears. Occasionally, a rock would fall from one side or the other with a roar and a crash, exploding like a ton of dynamite when it struck bottom, making us think our last day had come." I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.